Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
In the endless tug of war to place America's moral center, is it possible those lined up on the left are pulling the whole country in their direction? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. America has never suffered a shortage of proud and vocal social conservatives. And indeed, as of the 2014 midterms, the Republican Party has controlled both houses of Congress. But as my guest will explain, winning elections is a very different thing from winning the so-called culture wars. And many Americans who reliably cast ballots for staunch conservatives have nevertheless been influenced by progressive views on everything from racial equality to religious freedom to same-sex marriage. Stephen Prothero is professor of religion at Boston University. His new book is called Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So, is America becoming progressively more socially liberal?
I think so. If you look at the long view, you look at these culture wars we've waged over time, you know, from the beginning of the nation, as you try to follow them, as I did when I started researching this project, surprisingly, they all seem to end up in the progressive or liberal column, most of them.
As we noted in the introduction, you're a professor of religion. Talk about how faith plays into the culture wars in America, given the fact that despite occasional appearances to the contrary, there are both conservative and liberal people practicing religion in this country.
That's right. I mean, when you think of the more contemporary culture wars around abortion and gay marriage and things like that, the ones that started in the late 70s perhaps and continue today, those have tended to pit conservative Christians, particularly conservative Catholics and especially white evangelicals, against a secular left. But if you look back, most of the culture wars have been between religious people, so between people on religious folks on the left and on the right over some issue of inclusion into American family. You know, what kind of religions would be allowed to be considered American religions here?
So this idea that social conservatives take up causes that are already lost or nearly so, surely nobody's doing this deliberately. So how is it that they end up focusing on changing mores so late in the game?
Well, one thing that puzzled me was why conservatives seem to start the culture wars and why liberals seem to win them. If you're setting up a battle, you'd think you could set it up for you to win.
Yeah.
But as I was looking at this, it just seemed like they're kind of set up to lose. And if you look at this today, I mean, the Supreme Court finally settles same-sex marriage, right? And the population is moving around, is now in favor of same-sex marriage. And so it's a losing cause, and yet when you tune into the very first Republican debate for the Republican presidential candidates, they all line up against it, which kind of makes you sort of scratching your head like, oh, wait a minute, you're trying to get elected, and most Americans are now in favor of this, you're against it. But being on the losing cause, losing side there, underscores a narrative that's useful to getting elected. And you know that narrative is that America used to be great, and now it's lost its way. And you can see it's lost its way because it's pro-abortion and it's pro-gay marriage and it's lost its traditional Christian America foundation. And we're going to get it back again. And that may not sell at the presidential level in a national election, but it sells really well in local and state elections and in primaries. And you see this throughout American history of the conservative side picking a cause that's really close to being lost because that provides the sense of anxiety and fear that really drives the culture wars. And then they end up losing them, but they sort of win by losing, gaining at the ballot box by losing a particular cultural battle.
Stephen, when we talk about making America great again or somehow returning to the good old days, whose good old days are we talking about?
Well, that's part of the contest. I mean, culture wars are about, you know, what America's about and who is a real American. So, you know, you hear actually President Obama saying a lot, you know, that's not who we are. When he went to the mosque the other day, you know, he talked about bigotry against Muslims. He said, that's not who we are. And on both sides of this debate, that's really a big focus is, you know, what counts for the American family? Who are we as a country? And that's really the focus, you know, along with the, you know, twinning that to moral and religious questions is really the focus of what's going on in so much of the culture wars.
It's interesting when you talk about President Obama visiting a mosque. Of course, lots of people, a number of Americans believe that he was, in fact, a Muslim. And many people are quick to point out, no, that's not true. But the thing that doesn't follow that very often is, and what if it were true? Why should that matter?
Right. Why is it a smear?
Right, right.
Yeah. Why is it a smear to say that he's a Muslim, which we should, of course, point out that he's not a Muslim, that he's a Christian. But there is this sort of innuendo campaign. I mean, Donald Trump, when he went to the mosque, was asked about it, when President Obama went to the mosque, and Donald Trump said, well, maybe he feels comfortable there, you know, trying to hint at this possibility that he's a secret Muslim. I point out in the book, by the way, that he's not the first president who's been questioned about his bona fides as a Christian. And in fact, when Thomas Jefferson ran for president in 1800, one of the critics in an editorial in the Connecticut Current, which was a Federalist newspaper, the Federalists being the folks who were opposed to Jefferson, said, you know, what's up with this guy's religion? We don't know what religion he is. And, you know, maybe he's Jewish, maybe he's a believer in the Al-Quran, you know, which is to say, hey, maybe he's a Muslim. And President Obama actually mentioned that factoid from the book in his speech at the mosque, where he was saying, you know, hey, I'm not the first president to be accused of being a secret Muslim. You know, it's true. You can look it up.
Not bad company to place yourself next to Jefferson, I suppose.
Exactly.
Talk a little bit more about that election of 1800, like fraught with existential tension, as much as any election in this country has ever been.
Right. One thing historians like to do is when you say, man, this election's so nasty, the election of 2012, the election of 2016, it's probably the worst ever. And then historians get to say, actually, no, it's been worse, like the election of 1800. Yeah, it was pretty bad. You know, you had a fundamental disagreement. You were just having the party system emerging. So we were just kind of just starting to get political parties between the Federalists who were backing John Adams and then the Democratic Republicans who were backing Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, the disagreements were really fundamental about, should we have a strong central government? Should we have a basically agricultural or a more commercial economy? Should we be friends with France or with England? I mean, there were these fundamental questions about the formation of the country. But lurking behind that was a lot of character assassination on both sides and accusations of sexual infidelities. And then in the case of Jefferson, most strongly, accusations that he just wasn't a Christian. And even though we didn't have a religious test for higher office, that was not in the Constitution, how could we possibly elect this enemy of God who was going to make little old ladies in New England, which then was the conservative religious half of the country, interestingly, run out and, you know, bury their Bibles so they could dig them up again after Jefferson was no longer president. And so there was this big worry and smear campaign against Jefferson's religion. And, you know, interestingly, you know, we think about some people, at least, early America as a Christian America. We elected this guy who was really pretty out there, pretty unorthodox, and that didn't believe Jesus was God, barely believed in God himself. And so that was one early test of to what extent religion was going to play in the public space, and then to what, you know, does a president have to be Christian to be elected? And at least then the answer was no.
Why do American voters use candidates' religious beliefs or professed religious beliefs as a measure of their trustworthiness? I mean, anybody who is actively religious knows really good, really faithful people, and they probably know people who don't follow the rules so well regardless.
It's one of the puzzles of American public life. It's so different from Europe. I mean, you would never use the J word, the Jesus word, if you were running for office in France or even in England. It just was considered out of bounds. You know, politics is a secular pursuit. That's hypocritical or tawdry or kitsch of you to bring religion into it. And yet here we have the opposite situation, where we used to have, beginning in the late 70s, when the Republican Party really decided to talk more and more about God and values and family values and really turn itself into the Jesus Party. You know, we had from that time forward in my lifetime just one political party. But after 2004, and when John Kerry lost and the Democrats had this perception that they lost that election because of the values vote, they really started to get religion, you know, and Obama and Hillary Clinton since then have talked a lot about religion. So we really have two religious political parties. And I think one reason is Americans are overwhelmingly religious. Probably 95% of Americans believe in God. 75% of Americans are Christians. And the other is that we've never really had a fully secular public space. There's always been a religious presence there. And in my lifetime, in the last, say, 30 years, 40 years, increasingly that that public space that had been largely secular has been filled with religious information and with the religious claims. So, you know, when you saw Iowa, and especially the Republican primary, you just saw everybody bending over backwards, including Donald Trump, to be, you know, Mr. Christian and run an ad called Faith like Marco Rubio did, and run an ad showing your mother's Bible like Donald Trump did. And even Hillary Clinton was talking about God, and even Sanders, who interestingly is a secular Jew, kind of represents this group in America of the religiously unaffiliated, which is growing. You know, even he felt he needed to talk about his own religious and spiritual values in that context.
My guest is Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University and author of a new book called Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University and author of the new book, Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Stephen, it's almost laughable now to imagine a time when large numbers of people were actively resistant to any political influence by Catholics. What caused the dominant mainstream Protestants of the 19th century to rail against Catholicism?
I know, especially from here in Boston where I am, where it's been Catholic town.
Catholics,
I mean,
are all right.
It was this big revolution when we got an Italian Catholic mayor instead of an Irish Catholic mayor. Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, in my book, I start with the burning of this convent, this Ursuline convent just outside Boston, in the 1830s, and then with the Philadelphia Bible riots of the 1840s. And the fear really was that Catholics were a foreign power. You know, they wanted to make their way into the American public education system. They wanted to make us read their Bibles. They were kidnapping young women and holding them hostage in the basement of convents where priests would be raping them and then killing the babies that would result. I mean, these were the stories that were being told in actually very popular convent captivity narrative literature. You know, America had been Protestant from the beginning in terms of its demographics, right? The people here were largely white Protestants. They disagreed about which kind of Protestantism should reign here, but Catholics were really not much of a presence early on in the colonies or in the United States. I mean, there was some Catholic presence in places like Maryland, for example. But it really was a Reformation place, and the Reformation was to some extent hostility to priests and to the Pope and to Roman Catholicism. So as Catholics started to come here, you had this coming together of fears about, that's not unlike the fears we have now, some of us, about, you know, Mexicans coming over the border or Muslims coming to invade us. You know, this time it was Irish Catholics coming over the border and coming to invade us. And the idea was the Pope was going to take over the political system. There would be elected a bunch of Catholics because we had, you know, there would be areas that were Catholic dominated. And these Catholics were immoral. Their Christianity was false, fake Christianity. And they weren't proper Democrats, Republicans. They weren't proper Americans. They were going to vote the way the Pope told them to vote. And that fear didn't really fully dissipate until the second half of the 20th century. That was still around. But, you know, this is one argument I make in the book that you hinted at in the opening, that there are these fights that happen, and then the liberals tend to win them. But then over time, that liberal value, in this case, the inclusion of Catholics and the folding of them under the sacred canopy of America, ceases to be a liberal value. It just becomes an American value.
Do you see a relationship between past opposition to Catholics and to Mormons and the suspicion with which some Americans reflectively view their Muslim neighbors and this fear that, you know, having Muslims participating in government and sort of, you know, taking prominent roles in society means that the United States will somehow, you know, be under the influence of Sharia law?
I do. And in fact, that's why I wrote the book. I mean, I really started with the controversy over the Ground Zero Mosque a few years ago in Lower Manhattan when this Muslim gentleman had bought some land. He wanted to put in an Islamic community center a few blocks away from Ground Zero, and there was this big opposition to that, and especially by conservative Republicans. I didn't understand that because I thought that private property rights and religious liberty were these core principles of conservative, you know, republicanism. And so I really was trying to make sense of that, and that sent me back to the family values culture wars of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then that sent me back to earlier and earlier. And I do see parallels. I mean, the fight over Catholics was to a great extent over the fear that Roman Catholic canon law was going to become American law. It's the same argument as Sharia law. And it was equally specious then as now. I mean, Catholics did not imagine they were going to be able to turn America into a place run by a pope and run by archbishops, and you know they wanted to have a foothold here, but they didn't want to run America. They didn't think that was going to be anywhere near possible. The demographics weren't there for that, for one. So that piece is there, and in fact, there's a lot of parallels between the way the Catholic story and the Mormon story and the Muslim story all play out. And one of them, intriguing one, is the argument that these aren't even religions. You know, we have a First Amendment, and the First Amendment says we have religious liberty, and it doesn't really matter what religion you are, you still have religious liberty. And so one way around it, consistently throughout these many culture wars that I look at and why liberals win, is the argument that, well, Catholicism isn't really a religion. It's a political scheme. It's a scam to get the Pope to take over, you know, the Midwest, and then move from the Midwest, you know, out to the rest of America. Or Mormonism isn't really a religion. It's a financial scheme. You know, it's the way that Brigham Young, who's running the Utah territories, is lining his pockets with all these money. Like, it isn't about religion. You know, it's about money. And the same now with Muslims. You know, as critics of Islam bump up against the First Amendment, they make this claim that, well, Islam isn't really a religion, which is odd because it's the second largest religion in the world. Clearly grows out of two other religions, Judaism and Christianity. But no, it's a political scheme. It's an effort to take over the world, to turn the world into one, you know, caliphate is the claim. So a lot of parallels, yes, between these prior efforts to overlook the First Amendment and to basically banish certain religious people from the United States.
What's the history of the term Judeo-Christian values? Because I wonder how much people would have celebrated that at the founding of our country when, you know, I mean, American Jews are still a minority, but certainly they're, you know, assimilated and culturally accepted. I have to imagine they weren't welcomed with open arms. In fact, I know they weren't, you know, earlier in our history.
Right. So being Jewish was a slur also in early America. You know, a lot of the people who were arguing for a religion test that did not make its way into the Constitution were saying, look, that means we could elect a Jew as president. That means we could elect a Mohammedan, a Muslim, as president. Obviously, we don't want that. We can't have that. So, yes, and most of the areas in the colonies and then the early states, you know, Catholics couldn't vote. You know, Catholics couldn't run for higher office. I couldn't run for state office. And the same with Jews. And so really what happens is Judaism really doesn't get fully folded into the American fabric until World War II. And that's when you have, obviously, the Nazi regime, and you have so-called Christians in Europe calling themselves Christians, you know, killing Jews and perpetrating the Holocaust. And that leads to the emergence of this language of the Judeo-Christian tradition to kind of distinguish fascistic and Nazi Christians from the good Christians in America. that's when we start to think of ourselves as a Judeo-Christian country that has these values that are shared by both Jews and Christians. And one really interesting thing that happened after 9/11 was there was a really strong effort to fold Muslims into that and to create a Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition or an Abrahamic tradition, where you would think of these three as these sister religions that all believe in one God and believe God speaks to prophets and that the words of the prophets are written down in scriptures, and believe in, you know, heaven and hell and, you know, afterlife rewards and punishments and those kinds of things. And that was this sort of brief shining moment of American, you know, pluralism right after 9/11. And President Bush was really pushing for that with saying, you know, Islam is a religion of peace. We're not at war with Islam. We're at war with terrorism. But that really faded over time, and it's really a really distant memory now. And the language that candidates use now, of course, is Judeo-Christian values or Christian values rather than Abrahamic values.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Gary on the line in Plano. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a question about atheism and secularism. And I want to know what you think about that actually being left out of the conversation. We have so many discussions on in the media, and they talk about religious rights and this religion and the characteristics of this other religion, and yet there's a significant number of people in the country that are secular. The conversation never includes the question of, well, what about the idea that there may not even be a God?
Yeah, well, I'm not a theologian, so I can't really weigh in on whether there's a God or not. I'm a historian of religions, but the group of Americans who do not affiliate religiously is definitely growing. It's up to 22%. This is one reason for the strength of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. Bernie Sanders identifies as Jewish, but as a secular Jew, so he kind of slots in into that religiously unaffiliated category. At least he's close kin to those folks, and those folks tend to vote Democratic, and they tend to be more left Democratic, and so they fit with him. And certainly that's an important part of the story of religion in America over the last 10 years or so. That said, the percentage of those who do not affiliate with religion, sometimes these groups are called nuns, spelled N-O-N-E-S. They're not flying around like a flying nun. They're just the people who have no religious affiliation or claim to have none. Very few of them are actually atheists. In fact, atheist figure in America has held pretty steady in recent years, and 2-4% of Americans who say that they're atheists. So it's not a particularly large demographic. That may be one reason why you don't hear as much about them. But the demographic of people who aren't really religiously active and don't really consider themselves to be Christians or Muslims or, you know, Jews is almost a quarter of the population. It's an increasingly important demographic, both, you know, spiritually and also politically.
I want to go back for a minute to the recent fight over same-sex marriage. We know that there are still people who object, but, you know, sentiments certainly have changed. Interestingly, conservatives who did endorse same-sex marriage rights or have endorsed it found ways to couch those rights in very conservative terms, right? Marriage is inherently a stabilizing institution. It's good for society. Individuals should have the right to choose whatever life partner they wish. That sounds very conservative. Is this a common MO for making what have been liberal causes acceptable to conservatives?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It works both ways. I mean, when the battle started over same-sex marriage, I really was pretty convinced that it was going to end up at civil unions. That seemed to me the obvious middle ground, you know, to give gay and lesbian couples all the rights of married couples, but we would not call it marriage. And that might make the conservative Christians happy. That might make the gay rights activists happy. But the gay rights movement really took on what was a conservative argument that marriage is an important institution, that children raised in marriages that are stable do better, and why do we have this population of gays and lesbians who aren't allowed to enter into that conservative institution? And, you know, a lot of my gay friends, when that was happening, were saying, like, I don't want to get married. Like, that's for straight people. You know, why would I want to do that? You know, and that argument really lost out, you know. But you also find, you know, the flip side of where you have, you know, conservatives using liberal language, like the liberal language of, oh, Christianity is a besieged religion, right, that we're discriminated against as Christians. You know, religious liberty protects us too. You know, you hear Donald Trump talking about this when he was in Iowa, that Christians are this besieged group and they need to be protected. I'm going to protect you. You know, there's a war on Christmas. That kind of language is, that's where the right is borrowing from the outsider language of the left, the minority rights language of the left, and using that language for its purposes.
It might feel to many progressives today that the war on drugs represents a really strong conservative hold on the culture. Surely that's how many felt when prohibition was enacted. Can you talk about how that really disastrous experiment ended in victory for those who held more liberal views about alcohol use?
So one of my chapters is on prohibition and repeal. And it's such an interesting chapter, first of all, because it was so quick. I mean, culture wars usually take a while to play out. But in this case, you know, it took a little over a decade. And there was this real sense that something was awry. I mean, just like we have now among, you know, more conservative, culturally conservative people, you know, something's going wrong here. And this is a period of the real eruption of modernity into American culture in the 19-teens and the 1920s. A lot of different cultural forms, new kinds of music, new forms of dancing, an increasingly interracial society where blacks were coming up from the South into the northern cities and they were becoming more and more visible along with their culture. And cultural conservatives just fixated on the saloon as the problem. You know, somehow that was the magic bullet. If you could get rid of the saloon, get rid of all that drinking, somehow we could go back to an earlier America that was, you know, calmer and clearer and more homogenous. And I think a lot of what was going on in that particular culture war was about booze between the wets and the dries, but it was also about multiculturalism versus monoculturalism. You know, it was also about Protestants versus Catholics, you know, the Protestants who wanted to create this moral Protestant biblical society and Catholics who wanted to drink because that was part of their culture and there was nothing wrong with drinking. And I should say on that score, you know, they had a group that had their backs was the Puritans from New England, where I am right now, you know, and they were big drinkers. You know, I think about Puritans as being puritanical, but, you know, there was more beer on the Mayflower than there was water. And, you know, funerals in colonial New England, you know, had massive bills for alcohol. So that wasn't necessarily a Protestant, longstanding Protestant value, but it had become a Protestant value. And it was fascinating that turned around so quickly and that very quickly it was repealed. And the idea was we don't want the state to be taking away our liberties in the amendments to the Constitution. This was the first amendment to the Constitution that took away our liberty, the liberty to drink in this case. And that was pretty quickly reversed. But we did see a real growth in the size of the state because the state apparatus that needed to be created to try to enforce prohibition, and which didn't enforce it well, but the state had to grow. And it really created a pathway, I think, to the New Deal for the growth of the state there, and then a pathway to the culture wars in the 70s and 80s, where the government would again be used to try to enforce Christian moral positions, in that case, the moral positions against homosexuality and against abortion.
Stephen Prothrow is my guest. He's professor of religion at Boston University and author of a new book called Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Boston University Professor of Religion Stephen Prothero. His new book is called Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Stephen, if progressive social values are often eventually converted to widely held values across the political spectrum, why is it that so many voters cast ballots for candidates who hold and promise to protect socially conservative positions?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out as I was researching the book. I think that first of all, it's conservatives who do that. So as these become American values, for example, gay marriage, it's not going to be a winning play in 10 years to argue against gay marriage. And in fact, you even see that starting to slip in the Republican Party, where there's a lot of talk about Planned Parenthood still and abortion, because Americans continue to be somewhat divided on that question. But as we fling over pretty hard and fast, especially among young people, toward gay marriage, we're not really appealing to that. But I think what's going on is there's this, and we see it today, and I wrote the book really before Donald Trump, but he's sort of this poster boy for my arguments, that there is this narrative of loss and restoration that's really powerful in American culture, and it has a kind of Christian analog in the altar call that I was a sinner and now I've been redeemed, but also in the gospel story that we're, you know, we had the Garden of Eden and then we had the fall and then we have redemption. And so we tap into that story that, you know, we used to be a Christian America and we've fallen away and we will be one again. Or we used to have hometown and then the hometown got lost, but we can go back to those hometown values if only we get rid of New York values, right? So we have this narrative and all these culture wars slot into that. They all slot into it. So if, you know, if only the Catholics hadn't come, they wouldn't have disrupted this homogeneous Protestant America, or if the Mormons hadn't come, they wouldn't have upset the homogeneous Protestant America, or the Mormons wouldn't have upset family values, or the saloon wouldn't have upset the hometown or the village life that was disrupted by the emergence of the saloon. So I think there's a real tapping into that nostalgia for that, and then fear of change. You know, change is always happening, right? I mean, this is one thing historians observe, you know, there's no moment that just is static. So as change happens, there's always going to be one group of Americans, maybe roughly half of us, who just find that unnerving. And the other half of us are going to find that exciting. You know, so when Bernie Sanders speaks of revolution in the way that Thomas Jefferson spoke of, you know, we should have a revolution every generation or so in America, that's good for us. That makes some people excited. And then other people, it just makes incredibly, incredibly nervous that social order is going to go away and we're going to fall into chaos and fall into anarchy. And it's that group of people who feel anxious in the face of these social changes that fall back on these narratives of loss and restoration. And those narratives are being told today by people like Donald Trump and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And that's part of why they resonate.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Doug on the line in Rockwall. Hello, Doug.
Yes, hello, Chris. How are you, Professor?
Great.
I have a question for you, and it goes back to a book by the former judge Robert Bork, Sauching Towards Gomorrah. It's very, very close to your subject material today. This is my question. Radical individualism and radical egalitarianism. Those are the two terms Justice Bork used to show the inexorable move towards progressivism. He would say radical liberalism in his book. I wonder if in any way that was part of your research, the movement, which I guess really has its root in John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. I remember having to read that as an undergraduate. The final thought, and then I'll leave it to you here. The final thought is Bork also postulates that politics is a lagging indicator for class warfare. In other words, the ripple effects that you see in politics today have their roots in culture clashes that began perhaps decades ago. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks,
Doug.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, Bork is a culture warrior. So Bork, the slouching to Gomorrah, makes this argument that we hear a lot of cultural conservatives making in the 70s and 80s and 90s about how America has lost its moral bearings. We used to be a Christian society or a Judeo-Christian society. We've become a society of radical, where there radical is a bad word, individualism, radical egalitarianism, and probably more importantly, moral relativism. That's the Gomorrah idea, right? Gomorrah being the biblical, you know, reference to those supposedly gay people in, you know, Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah, or basically immoral people there. And that's where we're slouching toward. That's where we're headed as a nation. And this is just another, like, it's in the language of a jurist. But again, that's that narrative we were just discussing, that we used to be Zion. We used to be the New Jerusalem. We used to be the place where the pilgrims and the Puritans were coming to set up this shining city on the hill. But then we had this declension, this fall, and we forgot our moral bearings. We decided we wanted to catch fish instead of going to church. We decided we weren't going to pay attention to biblical morality. We were going to pay attention to our own selfish desires. We were going to stop being a community and we were going to start being individuals. So he very much stands in that Reagan Revolution tradition, the cultural side of it, as a culture warrior.
I want to talk about gun rights versus gun control. And I'm well aware that this issue does not track strictly along partisan lines, particularly here in Texas. But by and large, conservatives are known for pushing against gun regulation or restriction of weapons possession. And they seem to be winning this debate pretty handily at this moment.
Yeah, and I think that's a counterexample to the argument in my book. Mm-hmm. You know, part of why I do say, although don't say it in the title, usually, typically, most of the time, right?
It just gets in the way in a nice
snappy
title.
Yeah, you don't usually have those in titles, you know, which usually aren't written by authors anyway. But so, yeah, that's an important counterexample. I think you could argue, well, is it really a culture war? Because not everything is a culture war. Not every battle is a culture war. It has to, in my view, it has to touch on questions of morality and religion. It has to be heated. It has to be about who we are as Americans. But I do think the gun debate fits there. It's definitely a cultural battle. And you see it in places like, you know, Vermont, where Bernie Sanders is getting in a little trouble now for being in favor of gun rights. Well, you know, people in northern Vermont, northern New Hampshire, northern Maine, they're into their guns, you know, in the way that people in Montana are and people in Texas are. So I do think it's a cultural battle, and I think it's one that the conservatives are winning and the liberals are not winning it. I've tried to think about why, and I think one argument I make about why liberals win the culture wars is that conservatives pick lost causes. That's one reason. Demographics is another, that as you fight against Catholics and all of a sudden Catholics are 25% of the country, it's kind of hard to keep fighting against them. But another is the Constitution, you know, and that the Constitution is on the side of Catholics and Mormons and Muslims when it comes to religious liberty. It just is. And the Constitution is also on the side of gun rights. Now, whether it's on the side of AK-47s in every American home, that's not clear to me. But it certainly is something, it's a headwind for gun control people to push against. And they haven't been able to push against that headwind yet.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Andy on the line in Addison. Hi, Andy.
Good afternoon. What do we do with people who are insisting on the abolishing the Constitution and enforcing the rules on the American society?
Who are you talking about abolishing the Constitution, Andy?
Especially some Muslims who are trying to enforce Sharia law on communities, on judges, on rulings, on cities, and on states.
Any thoughts on that, Stephen? I haven't heard too much about that, but
yeah. Well, this is a big argument of cultural conservatives that really just doesn't have a lot of basis in fact. That there's these people who want to institute Muslim law, so instead of, you know, following the law of your town or of your state or of the United States, somehow we would all be following the law of the Quran and of Muslim jurists. This is a fantasy that is never going to happen, and that, you know, has the fantasy that the Pope, that papal law, that canon law was going to run the U.S. was a much greater possibility than this possibility. And I have a lot of Muslim friends. I have visited many mosques. This is just not something you hear about. I mean, it's at the very fringes of things, like people making arguments that their marriage, as it's being dissolved, that there should be some attention paid to Muslim law, like there might be some attention paid to Hindu law or to Jewish law, you know, as the judge is trying to decide. I mean, that's the basis on which, you know, people are pushing against this, but it really just isn't, you know, it isn't really anything to worry about any more than somehow Christmas is going to go away because the opponents of Christmas are going to eradicate it.
What do you think is the utility? And I don't mean to sound too cynical, because I think there are people who honestly feel this way. But why is there a sense among some Christians in the United States that Christians are a persecuted group?
Well, this flips as I tell my story, because initially the argument is that this is a Christian society. Christians are in the majority. So when the Supreme Court starts to push prayer out of the public schools in the 60s, or tells us we can't read our Bibles in the public schools in the 60s, we, the silent majority, as Nixon called them, we, the moral majority, as Jerry Falwell and Ronald Reagan called them, should stand up and make our society Christian again. That was the dominant narrative. It was a majoritarian narrative. That narrative shifted in the 90s toward, we Christians are a persecuted minority. It's a really interesting move, right? I mean, Christians are the majority, 75% of Americans now, 85% probably in the 80s. But I think the reason that that rhetoric is used is because it's effective, because it's the underdog narrative, it's the victimhood narrative, it's the rights of the minority narrative. It's a kind of seizing of a progressive narrative. You know, we African Americans should have equal rights. We women should have equal rights, right? We Christians should have equal rights. Why don't we have our equal rights? And I think that as we shift from a Christian-dominated society where Christian norms were always the norms, right? Where, why is Sunday a day off? Because it's the Christian Sabbath, right? We're not following the Muslim day off of Friday or the Jewish day off of Saturday. We're following the Christian day off. But as those privileges go away, you know, as those privileges are challenged by a multi-religious society, that feels to Christians like loss. I would analyze that as moving from a position of dominance or power or even hegemony to a position of, you know, equal religions. But that's not how it's perceived by a lot of conservative Christians. It's perceived as, oh, the Muslims are coming and instituting Sharia law, you know, rather than, oh, we are now living up to the promise of the First Amendment, and we're seeing ourselves as a multi-religious society where no religion is supposed to have any, it to be favored over another religion.
Stephen, the United States has moved more slowly than Western Europe toward liberal shared values, but certainly we've moved much more quickly than other parts of the world. What aspects of a culture determine its overall openness to change?
Boy, that's a big one. I mean, obviously, religious conservatism is one thing, and that is a place where we're different from Europe. You know, so that's a place where we stay moored in the past and in our hometowns and in our churches and things like that. I think that that's definitely part of it. And I think there's a tug of war, and always has been. And I think this is why we have always had culture wars. And this is something that distinguishes us from other Western democracies, is that we never really settled this religion question. You know, we have all these Enlightenment values in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights about liberty and about equality. But then we have these traditional values that inhere in our population, that we get in our churches and to some extent in our synagogues. And there's always been a tussle there. You know, we don't have God in the Constitution. We don't have religious tests for the presidency. And yet we have chaplains who serve in our military, and we have prayers that open the meetings of the U.S. House and of the Senate. So we just keep muddling through with to what extent we're looking to a kind of homogenous religious past, and to what extent we're looking toward a more, you know, multi-religious or secular future. And we've never really settled that. And that's why we keep having these fights.
Stephen Prothero is professor of religion at Boston University. His new book is called Why Liberals Win the Culture Wars Even When They Lose Elections. Stephen, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us today.
Thanks, Chris. I enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter, at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.